This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on location today. Our guest is Amy King. Here she is.
Thanks, Grace. The first poem I'm going to start with is called Record Keeping. Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must remain silent. Wittgenstein. These are the things you think you said. It's just that I have no way of knowing what to tell you. I fill you full of roots and prefixes, signifiers, and the dialectic, and still, my company mixes with the party. I won't toe the line, though. Better the diagnoses than these prescriptions. Herein my drink remains displaced. She ambles along in her careful constructions. Against the wall, she overlaps her shadow upright. The table over there boasts refreshments. When I say, I am of, does that follow with good riddance? The end of man often lies at hand, but whereof can one not speak? It is on the table, it is in my grasp, it is soaked into the carpet. As a woman, my permission opens me aimlessly. I move my mouth and walk therein.
As a woman, what is that line?
As a woman, my permission opens me aimlessly.
Indeed. Amy King. And today we are on location, which means we are fraught with engineering problems, but now I think we're on the right vibration. And we're going to talk to Amy about her work and her life and her teaching. Here she is. She's the winner of a Lambda Book Award, and it was entitled Antidotes for an Alibi. She also has a chapbook. She has another manuscript on the table, and she teaches creative writing and English at Nassau Community College. And right now we're going to hear some more work and hear what makes Amy tick.
As if a lantern in love led. Like you, I have forgotten everything spoken so far. I knew the dinosaurs and their history, and I have a complex tie that longs to be subtracted. Altogether, we make each other up. I gave you a little slice of heartache to latch onto, and a 60-pound cumulus cloud cools her way straight to the top. Bashfully, enamored eyes descend as we speak silently above the moonlit stove of midnight.
If I said to you that you very much wrote influenced by film, would I be the first person to say that?
No, you would not be the first person to say that. My work is informed by film because, I'm from a generation, Generation X, as you might be aware, and we grew up sort of a little bit watching films, watching TV, not quite ready for the internet. And reading books, of course, because my parents' generation read books and they encouraged that. But I see a contrast with the generation I'm teaching now, whatever they're called, Generation Y, or they have other names. But they very much grow up reading, just being on the internet and watching TV and, you know, having videos popped in because their parents both worked and they don't have time to come home and be encouraged to read books necessarily. So the reason I bring that up is because I'm very aware of their short attention spans and my own short attention span. So my poems are fraught with images, mm-hmm. and juxtaposed, and they leap. And
As long as you get to the other side, leaping mm-hmm. is fine. Mm-hmm. Do you think you get to the other side?
The other side, sure.
Do any of your students come in and doggedly want to write poetry with a subject and a verb, and they are entrenched in the narrative, or is that a thing of the past?
No, they're not entrenched in the narrative. They are, their biggest inclination, we'll call it, is to be very abstract, because I don't think that they have a lot of experiences at the ripe old age of 17, 18, 19. So they write lots of, you know, love poems and being hurt in love, and maybe my own poems. They tend to like my poems. I sneak them in without my name on them. I don't really like to say, read my poems. But they tend to like them, and I think it's because of encouraging them to notice images and put them into their own work. They want to see how that's done.
Let us see how it's done.
I'll read a sort of a narrative poem, kind of long, called My Head on Fire, Dull But Glowing. 1. A miniature salamander rears his tiny head in the halls of Discordia, praying a mantra to stand for the supple flag he hopes reveals our segues. And really, I am only talking to myself in the hidden corner of this cafe, because no one else can hear what I've just said. That woman's a genius, and I want more than anything for her to know the use of position. More than anything, I want to know the position of her hidden position. I walk the sidewalk backwards in turquoise slippers of dust mites, beside graffiti taller than me, and on a whim in an adjacent alley, a rapist makes his third hit this week. Our Christmas tree this year is a kind of metal thing with lights, and I'm lying about us when we're only me and the four-legged beings toe-tapping shadows across my one-room apartment. Everyone knows what the world's all about, and for prophecies and rapt attention, they fashion speakers from used tin cans, and we pay with our rapt attention. After days over days of shoveling, it comes down to a matter of longing, and the emotions we stretch to hide, the strength of longing, and her quiet ability to bury its enduring company. Longing whispers like a whisper back in the mirror at 3 a.m., a shot in the dark, with the light turned toward my head on fire, dull but glowing, in the middle of a shrink-to-fit silence, in the middle of existence, staring back wistfully in silence. And a newer longing freezes my face as smoke signals from my ears spell out my most intimate secrets, the point of which is lost or muted to anyone paying zero attention to rerun spinoffs of reality television. And the smoking embers pedal these softly padded slippers forward, then backward again, retracing my historical progress. When I leave this malleable planet, which questions should I ask? Was the grass scratching my tender soles stroked and fed enough? Did the strangers in my building hear my passive voices? Is bearing witness the same as standing aside with cigarettes on lonesome streets in movies? I, who do not smoke, bend at the waist to leave pieces of silver in the cracks of my own wake, lures to siege stranger distractions. 2. If love is an answer, how long is the question? I don't forgive or mistrust the law. I am an acute public citizen. I often excuse sin and doubt its real relevance. My breasts will never make the magazines, and I stand smitten by supplemental shame. The law heeds no boundaries, and I long for a country that keeps the perfume of death out of my back pocket. How is it that no one ever died in my presence? Out back, the turnips bury their bodies, preparing for their resurrection. More than most fruit, they rot to the skeletons, and their bones become vapors eluding the steps treading their graces. Lengthwise, I inhale bacteria and ache. My relatives are all marrow and blood over innocence to me. The air in my palace is heavy with night. 3. As a child, I climbed the nursery school fence where Tommy sliced his arm in two on the razor top we had so tenderly avoided. I am telling this, above all else, a true story. I possess regrets I avoid in repetition. Blueberry jam never soaks in, and the toast tastes drier than bread. My kitchen is a woman's nest of anti-domesticity, of anti-cooking lessons. I told my southern uncle about my mess. He promised me a wife this forthcoming holiday and blessed my smoldering head. Above all, I am repeating a true story. The ancients have gathered outside my only door. I am at home in the open hand only. Through the peephole, they look like the statues of granite reproductions. I hear our committees profess Eureka and remember, at least, that a cook can never leave her rice alone in hopeful isolation. By now I have fallen asleep in love with a person of ephemeral dimensions. The sandpapered walls sound hollow without my usual absence. As the sun softens its part, my breathing vibrates in tension. I am the nexus of a pendulum motion, a hand back and forth in goodbye and hello emotion. Tomorrow my darker hair ages in honor of the woman who gave her body to science, who fell asleep at the wheel, exacting her donation. Between the pauses of retreating ancients stand the imminent spaces of genius, and from today on I wave my salamander flag for these burning recognitions.
That is an ambitious piece of writing, and I don't think you come to that as the first thing you write.
No.
That takes a while.
Yeah.
Could I just ask you the process for that? Was it written in pieces?
No, it's probably more like an Elliott Wasteland getting pared down kind of thing. It was longer, and I think I took a lot out, and so it sounds more choppy and maybe more of a love song of Jail for Prufrock.
How long, how many hours do you think is in that?
I don't recall. I don't think it took me that long to write, actually, because it's more narrative. And I think that we're more inclined to write stories. And there's some autobiographical stuff in it, some just, you know, stuff from observations. And so I think it started off as a longer piece, and I just took chunks out later. I think the editing is the hard part, so that it doesn't spin into complete nonsense. But there is still some anchor, some grounding there that, you know. But I think it's, you know, on the flip side of that, I think it's difficult to make a poem into complete nonsense, because everyone's mind, especially the active mind, tends to assign a narrative to whatever you hear.
That is Amy King talking, and I am Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem. We're on location, and we're talking and listening to new work by Amy. Some published, we'll be hearing some new. In a way, isn't your writing a way of saying all the world is fiction? I mean, I see a line like the strength of longing and acute public citizen. There are powerful words there where you take a stand about where you are in the middle of the poem. But in a way, the way you put things together, you're really saying we are making up everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we make each other up, the line from another poem I just read. I think that all narratives, I mean, that's why they're called narratives, because we each have created something. We assign ourselves narratives every day. I mean, the world doesn't happen with Amy woke up and then took a shower. I mean, lots of things happen in between, including our thoughts that intervene with our reality, or with what we call the reality of the narrative or whatever. And I think those are backburnered, as though thinking is not part of the reality, you know?
Do you think that this time in history that we are seeing a different kind of poetry from a permission? You mentioned the word permission in your first poem, mm-hmm. where maybe the Cultural Revolution actually started, broke the ground, and something is allowing us to be who we are mm-hmm. without fabrication? Or am I stretching a glide?
No, I think that there is a lot of awareness now among poets, particularly because we deal with words, obviously, an awareness of how many narratives are being spun and how they manipulate the public. I mean, if you didn't detect it, I have a certain awareness of being an American who is subjected to lots of public discourse that is trying to make me believe one way or another, and it's very often persuasive and this sort of thing. I think poets are trying to grapple with, you know, this awareness, and also with the way the narratives manipulate us and kind of either undo them or turn them on their head and make fun of them. There's a lot of sarcasm now, I think, in poetry.
The air in the palace. What inspired that line?
The air in the palace. Well, we all have lived, you know, I think where we live is our palace, and it's the place that you do give yourself permission to write as you see fit. You're not in a class. You're not writing for someone who's assigned you a task. You asked me earlier about who my audience was, and now that I've had time to think about that, I kind of think that my audience is, I said to you at first, myself. I don't really write with anyone in mind. But when I say myself, I mean myself as far as how I construct myself and present myself. I'm very aware that when I'm writing poetry, that people will often read it as an autobiographical thing. And I don't think that I'm necessarily being autobiographical, but I think that as an American, and as I just mentioned, you know, the things that come at me from outside of me are also the things that make me up. And so in the palace or in your own home, that's where you get to deconstruct those things and fool around with those things and put them together in a new way and get some control on them. Mm-hmm. Because you can walk outside and someone says, okay, you are a white middle-aged woman and you have this class background and this sort of thing. And in order to get control over that public discourse, you have to be able to take that home with you and say, okay, I am this, this, and this. Let me spin this on its head and show you what else I can be, and show you that this is a narrative. This is what you've assigned to me, and this is not all that I am. I can be more and or less, you know.
I also liked it for a more down-home reason, because in that it is very fanciful. I like to locate you. Mm-hmm. I always like to locate you for the accountability mm-hmm. of the poem. And there is a trustworthiness in the poem where you do own up mm-hmm. to being the person here I am in the palace, and I'm mm-hmm. doing this thing. Mm-hmm. Let's hear another poem. This is Amy. I'm Grace.
Okay. Speaking of constructing the self, I'll do Doppelganger. Doppelganger. I know there is a town in another country where a woman who is exactly like me answers her phone with the same hope, hangs up on her mother and lover guiltless, one after another, a tiny harem in charge of her life. Over there, she dreams identical bad jokes that end with the punchline, hammerhead. She has powdered the precise number of bottoms I have. I am not the most willing aunt, neither is my synonym. In fact, even her dog barks with a familiar hoarse hiccup. We must be aligned through the stars, like tonight. She is looking out at a similar audience, reading a like-minded poetry to people who look like you, with quotation marks around her words, words that reflect my existence too. You know her well in her other land because you shift your gaze from her back to me like a tennis match in the distance between us.
I'm glad you read that because one thing you like to do is break down time.
Mm-hmm.
And timelessness is very interesting in your work because just the crossing of distance to an imagined other self mm-hmm. is real using time mm-hmm. the way you want to use it on your terms.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also glad you talked about T.S. Eliot because I find you very well founded in the classics and American canon of poetry, so that when you come into a new experience, you're not doing it without having brought something along.
Yes. I don't know how well read I am, but I've certainly been influenced by a lot of American poets. I just wanted to say something about Doppelganger, getting back to what we were talking about before. Doppelganger, I think, I don't like to say why I wrote a poem, but I think that was inspired by this idea that people tend to look for a familiarity within each other. I'm for some reason, people often, maybe it's because I'm friendly or something, but people often say, oh, you remind me of someone. And it's varied from, you know, someone they went to high school with or, you know, a cousin or whatever. And I've wondered about this inclination of people to try to find some familiarity with each other. And I think that that's what draws people to poetry, actually, is this desire to have this familiarity. But also, poetry, it's not a story. It's not something to make us just feel comfortable and familiar, because that's what familiarity does, right? It makes us feel secure with each other. But people look for it in poetry, but they also look for what is not familiar. So this doppelganger is sort of a hyper-awareness of this drive to be familiar, this drive to have somebody else like us out there. And the reason I want to undo that kind of, I want to unsettle it, because I think that people actually equally, at least equally, want to be, find something unfamiliar. We talk about difference in the PC terms and the tolerance term, you know, we have to tolerate difference. Well, what does it mean to really tolerate difference? We're attracted to it, but we're afraid of it too. So when we make these unsettling poems, you know, these things that unsettle each other, though we're nervous about it, that brings us to each other in a closer way. Mm-hmm. Because it's kind of the same idea of, well, we can be similar as humans and we, you know, but at the same time, I want to learn something from you that I don't know or that I'm not comfortable with.
Well, your poetry is clearly political. All poetry mm-hmm. is political. But in its form, it is saying that also.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you ride this out very much in content and in the way you present. And let's hear another one, and then I'll see if I'm right or not.
Okay.
Amy King.
Here's one from Antidotes for an Alibi called Another Tradition. The stone wall faded and no one felt the revolution over their shoulders anymore. Wrapped in paper, set upon the shelf in the anteroom, the remainder shed their insane gestures, returning to ply the original trades, prostitutes, busboys, and salutations. The money rose straight to the top. Terror wars commenced and the fires rained upon the fields. In another dimension, freedom couldn't be the same. People disbanded from groups altogether, learning only the lights of neighborhood asylums. God fell apart and words keenly followed. To say, I need you, now meant spread the butter and adhere to mobility. Across the laps, they stretched each other, stroking to convey the influence of contentment.
Are you saying that you do trust language, or that saying I love you means spread the butter, or both?
I'm saying, well, this is sort of an idea. I actually wrote this well before, you know, we went and attacked Iraq. I think I'm saying that though we have this sense of unification and security, you know, this is how the current regime has taken over, you know, our civil rights, is feeding on this fear, this illusion that we have a complete security with each other as these United States. And in fact, we're very provincial people. Even in living in New York City, I'm very, you know, I live in my little neighborhood, and I live in my other little neighborhood at work, and I know a lot of people there. And what I'm saying is, you know, even though you say, I need you, it could just be something as simple as pass the butter. You know, you're here for me, I'm here for you. We live in these small ways.
And it's also saying that language is the way people try to persuade other people. I mean, there is always, you're always looking at it from the outside in a way, and evaluating it and saying, I know how you're using these words, you know, and this is another way. This is a response to that. I think that's the poet's job. This is Amy King. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're together. She teaches in New York. She's received a MacArthur Scholarship for Poetry. She has two advanced degrees, one from Brooklyn College and one from State University of New York, Buffalo. And she conducts interviews for MePo Radio, which are really, I think, changing the network of the web a lot. She was an undergraduate at Towson University, and we're going to hear another poem.
Okay. I'll read a poem called Scattered Horses. This was actually written while I was looking at a drawing by a current singer. So you can't really see the drawing, but maybe you'll get the idea. Anyway, Scattered Horses. Starting from the bottom is one way up. Electric ghosts in the bones of his face go for the heaven of his red-shoed heart. They click Lilliputian heels off page with a painted cross on a candy cane, just as the bandito put his hand against mine. We were meant to leave by the window with tattoo and spiraling gallops, like we're wired for puzzles or mazes, spoken over whinnying yawns, warm whiskey baths, and the likes of you into me, all three, if only arm in arm we run, another entity emerging between us. And every offspring is finger-lined love, brushing daylight's moon above, our heads, scattered horses in the ceiling.
That's Amy King, who in poetry is changing things so that we're not in a lockstep progression toward I don't know what, being archaic maybe. She brings the experience of being alive to the page and shows it just like it is. And sometimes we have to go for the experience and not say, well, where is she now and what is the ideology of this? But we did say poetry is political. And I did tell you I read a book by Ellen Gilbert, an author you do know. And he says many interesting things, which I see you living. One is that you have gathered a huge audience on the grassroots level, and that is widening nationally. Now, that's a little different from the way poetry used to be. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I'm aware of it. I went to school with Ellen Gilbert, but I honestly, I haven't read much of his critical writing, which I will actually be doing. But yeah, I think that critics now are becoming aware of, because we live in a consumer culture and because we have a lot of things available to us, a lot of materials available to us, we can publish our own work now. We don't have to rely on one person at the head of a huge publishing company to say, okay, this is good enough, we'll publish this or we want this. Now we can write outside of what is marketable and publish it ourselves. And this gives us a new permission to do the things that, I mean, poetry has many purposes. Sometimes people just want it to beautify and make aesthetically pleasing, you know, and this is a nice tradition. And I think this is the one that tends to get marketed the most. So small presses look for something else. They don't need to reproduce, you know, aesthetically pleasing verse.
But I have to jump in and say that you yourself have never published your own work, which is also important in that there's a small press community and we're all supporting each other. You have won an award which published your work. You are nationally published in literary journals. So it's not like you're saying, I mimeograph these poems.
Right.
I had to say that also.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think all of the great poets, though, started in small press. Can you name one who didn't? I mean, all of them. Wallace Stevens, T.S. Eliot, William Carlos Williams.
Yeah, I think Whitman is the one to be most appreciative of. Whitman self-publishing his own book throughout his life. I mean, if you really believe in yourself, you do that. You know, you write, you publish your own work if that's what it takes.
You bring up another phenomenon of today, which I think you are an example of, an exemplar maybe, and that is that in cyberspace, I think you and I both love the way of connecting globally mm-hmm. on this radio network. And then it brings up the problem of image and person. Mm-hmm. So the image of who you are out there is really unrelated to the person sitting here, and you have to deal with that mm-hmm. because they're talking to the image. Mm-hmm. I get this all the time on radio. Mm-hmm. People are talking to my image, and that's fine with me because I can send that out there and stay home. Mm-hmm. But don't you find that we have to deal with the multiplicity of being, the doppelganger?
Absolutely. I think that anytime you produce anything, the risk is that you are presenting a persona. That comes back into the work, though, an awareness of, okay, I'm creating this, and, you know, someone is going to read this as me or read this as, you know, this is Amy King or whatever. I mean, it's kind of like you have to make your choices and be careful about them. I mean, actors aren't the people they're portraying, but nonetheless, they have to decide on the roles they're going to do and if they find them worthwhile and, you know. So I'll read another poem, speaking of presenting Amy King. This poem is called I Too Am Chicken. An author thinks she knows more than she does. She knows even less. For example, someone else wrote this. Thoughts approach in the shower. She watches them haunt her swirling tides. That's the cliche declarative. She thinks, whenever I exist, people name me at the gate. I trip over my own grass velvet heart, and I am the only person left on this flight. In the distance, I see no one who can take off and no perfect landing. Alas, her red robin eyes to and fro twitch lightly in their sockets.
So there are new ways of thinking in poetry, and poetry is always writing against resistance. Certainly people of color. Another thing that your friend Alan Gilbert said was that white feminists care mostly about the cause of feminism, mm-hmm. white feminism, which is a big cause and it could fill the day. But I tended to disagree with that. And the only thing in the book I disagreed with, really. Mm-hmm. What is your thought about that?
I don't think that only white feminists care about feminism. If anything, I noticed that a lot of women who are not white care about feminism also.
A lot of men, too.
A lot of men, too, absolutely. I can't even leave out men because that's not fair. I mean, I think it comes from a position of privilege. One has to recognize, you know, just as, you know, how do I say this? A lot of male poets I know nowadays risk, you know, or want to break the facade that men are one particular way, the center of power, the, you know, not sensitive, not feminine, not able to empathize, this sort of thing. And I think that you see that now in a lot of, as you call it, the grassroots poetry, an awareness that we are in a position that has traditionally been given a lot of power. And it's not the responsibility of the disenfranchised, of the people who are not in power, to say, hey, you know, to keep saying, hey, you have the power, stop doing that, share it with us, you know, that it doesn't work like that. I think actually James Baldwin is one of the bigger writers who's promoted this idea that until the establishments change themselves, until, you know, you can see the non-white person reflected in society, things aren't going to change. But it's the responsibility of the white person to recognize that discrepancy, that, oh, I have a lot more than other people do, or I have a lot more capabilities or a lot more permissions than other people do. And poets are now saying, let's point these out. Let's show how this works. Let's show how this is perpetuated through the language, through the narratives that we're talking about.
That's Amy King. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem. From the Library of Congress, today is On Location. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and we're going to continue with this dialogue. Amy King is shifting the conversation. She's organizing it differently. She's making new thoughts in a different way. And this is actually an aesthetic. So let's hear another poem, and we'll delve more into that.
Okay. I will give you a strange little poem. Lost at Sea Daily. The guy who shares my work has flown off to Croatia for the rest of his life, which churns my sea legs heavier than days preceding. You see, I am in this navy coat crashing about, and then I am at your door knocking the news through to you that you never seem to open. And these sleeves have become a protective measure, with their hard anchors buttoned, the collar a stiff relic of many conjectures spun for those not yet burdened by off-center trade winds. From this dock, I ride these reeling jaunts as extensions of my daytime sleep. A sea slug's awareness of manning the oars under caterpillar lights pitching forth. Squinting shoremen understand it's just like sailing, except you don't sail. Underneath this sky, I could be the one on my way to Croatia if I just kept rowing.
There we have again the split self, or the self as part of others, or maybe an equity of spirit. Maybe we're all one in a way, you're saying, and I'm going to take responsibility for the other part of me, which is in you. Is that too high flown?
No.
I liked it.
I think it's, yeah, I think it's sort of about responsibility, and you can look at someone else and envy their position, but, you know, the better thing, I think, is to look at yourself and say, well, what are my potentials? What can I do?
Amy is the managing editor for the journal Me Poesis. Tell me how that works. How do you become a managing? What do you manage? I have heard you on air, but what is the managerial part of it?
Well, it's really very simple, actually. I accept submissions, and I often solicit work from people. I think I have a good eye as far as what's worthwhile. Of course, everybody thinks that about themselves, but I think that I mean, it's a position of power, too. I think that I look for work that I think is exemplary and needs to be out there. And the internet is one way, is a huge way now. I think that you'd be blind not to use the internet and its resources to promote poetry these days. And being a managing editor of Me Poesis means finding work that I think is worthwhile and making sure it gets out there and it stays out there, because the internet, until electricity stops, the internet is going to be with us, you know. People say, well, the internet is ephemeral, it doesn't last. I have work on the internet that's been on there for 10 years. I have work in journals that maybe the top press run was 2000, but it's disappeared. So I think that there's a great responsibility with, you know, being a managing editor and choosing work that's going to remain online and available to multiple eyes for a long time.
Here's a biggie. What of the materiality of the text once it is not on paper?
What of the materiality? Well, I don't mean to diss journals. It's very nice to have a book in your hand and look at it. And as we know, books are, you know, where we preserve things. They'll be in libraries for hundreds of years and often become rarities and valuable and, you know, this sort of thing. But this doesn't, I don't think this lends to change that poetry promotes and influencing people. I think that we live in a consumer culture. Our country is very much a service-oriented country now. We don't sell products as much anymore, and that means we have a lot of people online daily. And I think that that means the average office worker can stumble across poetry much more readily and easily than if they had not sought a book of poetry out in a bookstore. The materiality that, I'm sorry, you mentioned the materiality. Well, the materiality is not just word ink on a page. The materiality is also the oral, you know, what you're hearing. So very often the reader, him or herself, is making the materiality of the language out by reading it aloud to themselves or in their head. And getting the textures in their mouth and the sounds and in their own ear. I mean, it's one thing to hear somebody read their work or to see it on the page. It's another thing to hear it in your own head. Because as you know, and I'm sure you've had this happen, you've read a poem over and over and it's meant one thing in your head. And then when someone else has read that same poem, it could mean something completely different. So I don't think you need the page just to create that that sense of meaning.
Well, whether we need it or not, there it goes.
Yeah.
Here she is, another poem.
Okay. The living still have their names. One, people who have seen me think that something's up. They look deep through my leaves at the roots I have gathered into knots and piecemeal lassos. From this Union Square Park, I peek between fingers at Tuscany, a spring in Berlin's distance, and open wider for dentures certainly coming my way. In a world of wax over paper curtains, I am known for causing traffic jams. Slinking down the wall like a gelatinous dog, I've always suspected the ladies I've known long for more than silk butterflies. They watch the index finger's trajectory. One girl in red pants guessed at my architecture, but I never let on. This smiling city with a total dispatch of 10 plus us watches chronic futures weave and segregate, unfolding on the sidewalk, unfurling at our steps in soiled cocktail dress. Nearby, a visible woman's hand counts minutes, the first allusion to clock-like wisdom. She inserts aging powder from the skin of her purse into hands against the steering wheel. She ignores old needs and fashions tunes that fight for her cause, should she reinstate one. I offer no proof for any of this. There is no photo except of the past. I trace her lines of black mascara, blotted out gestures, and the hammer on that woman, surprise and surprise. My audio mission until the end has been to lend an ear to the chaos of practical measures, an answer to exact scenery, one that gives up the goods with a spoon in her back and on autopilot floats the same scream and whistle down congruently empty streets. Casual patrons between sips avoid them. Two. Now we'll turn to talk about everyone and everything in this particular environment. You thought you were alone room-wise with the rest of us, but she flashes between in-person bodies, whispers to present tense ears. A music is not a home. She won't adhere to personal space. She won't appear as a potted plant. When I write her or hands against, I don't always mean the woman in question. For example, writing repetition has its limits, but not on such a woodpecker's bench for seesawing. We ride, we raid, electronically, we deviate. We occlude, denude, and expatriate. These symptoms resist contemporary sense-making. I grew up on a balcony with two white rabbits and one clay flower pot, respectively. Details don't invest in narratives. We do it for them. For the moment, blood is only part of what I'm bleeding. I've found ways to get my rabies below the antibacterial radar. You, who were my first windshield, enabled the roads to dust-cut conclusions. Planted on this bench, I am hard hit that my tears are alone against my cheeks. As a well-trained American, my focus shifts toward the hunt for a better bargain and an ever more dire diagnosis. It's never been easy knowing an emergency often happens in my absence. As usual, I have failed to draw a history of the present placid. You, however, in a short but future distance, can go through the span of our solar system and touch the breath of stars that were never ours in passing. If you ask about the desert, you'll find I never made it. Long ago, I learned behavior beside a church when I turned to my neighbor and said, "If you die tonight, rise up and call me at first light." With our go-between wires, dawn hereby arrives behind the sounds of residual persons in sight.
The way you disrupt the expected response is this way. Two white rabbits and a clay pot can't be respectively. How can two living things and one inanimate thing be respective? Mm-hmm. So right away, I wake up and I say, why do you want us to wake up? Mm-hmm. Just give me a one-sentence answer. Why not lead ourselves to slaughter the way it's always been?
Because I don't really think that I am here to comfort you.
Also, I think it's your impulse. I don't think you're saying, this is my political view. I think it's an impulsive. The artist is very impulsive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Some of it's intuitive.
Oh, a lot is intuitive. But through the centuries, every poet, I say, let's go back to Whitman. Mm-hmm. Every poet in America has always thought he or she was moving consciousness forward. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like innovation is new, really, is it?
Yeah, no, you're right. And that's a responsibility, I think, of the poet. I mean, one of the responsibilities, I should say. Not every poet feels that way. But,
oh, really?
Well, I don't know. I think that there are many poetries. Some poetries just comfort. or pleas or titillate or something like that.
You talked about the students coming in with abstractions. And I think we all at one point said, I'm cold, I'm lonely, mm-hmm. I am sad, and thought that was a poem.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Those are the three lines. Now, what does it take to get them from there to saying that I'm in the middle of a palace? Mm-hmm. What does it take?
Well, practically speaking, I focus on metaphor. I mean, I tend to say assign an image to that because your love is very different from my love. Now, your love might be, you know, a tank coming down the street with guns firing, and my love might be, you know, a wilting little mm-hmm. yellow rose crushed on the sidewalk. So I tend to focus on getting them to understand how metaphor works, first of all. I mean, that's the beginning, and that's actually a very primary part of a basic creative writing class that I do.
Well, I feel that that says a lot. Mm-hmm. That's very primal, and that's very significant and very clear-cut. And then after that, what happens?
I don't know. After that, we go with, well, I mean, I do different things with them. Sometimes I get them just to, because I teach the basic creative writing class, I get them to write a short story, and I'll get them to just, or I'll get bring something in that's very picturesque, and I'll have them take out phrases and play around with them. There are different methods you can use mm-hmm. to get them to just put things together that they didn't imagine, couldn't imagine being put together before.
Do you have them read conventional poetry?
I do have them read a mix. I have them read conventional work. I have them read my contemporaries' work. I have them read work from other countries because they might not ever find it on their own. I think it's important to see work from other countries, too, so that they can see. I mean, maybe they won't recognize it right away, but they can get a sense of, well, Americans are looking at this, but, you know, Peruvians are looking at that, you know. And so it's important to expose them to lots of different poetries, contemporary and traditional.
And finally, if they come in and write something radical for the sake of being radical, mm-hmm. at what point do you know that they need to be guided, even though it may be innovative, even it may be charged, unleashed? At what point do you want to put a tether on that, if at all?
I don't really put a tether on it. I mean, maybe some of them will be a smartass and say, I'm going to put just a bunch of words together and call it a poem and see what she says, you know. Mm-hmm. That actually hasn't really happened to me, but, you know, I'm sure there have been instances of this. I think my response would be, hey, go with it. Do some more. Try to do something else with that. And then, hey, why don't you write a story around that, you know. I mean, the tendency, I think, the thing you're asking about is people's concern that, well, how far is too far, you know? And as I said, I think that as readers and, you know, people who create narratives every day, which we do, it's very difficult to look at three words in a row and not assign some sort of sense to them, you know, even though they are nonsensical together, seemingly so.
The poet is a cultural worker, and the teacher is a cultural worker, and when you put them together, you get something happening. But if the poet is a writer first, then that's something we have to pay attention to. So let's hear another.
Okay. The spirit is near. Spirit is near. Wrapped in personal pity, betrayer Sphinx slinks and eats. He privately shuffles our motivations. I like the capability of my eyes, the way they brighten the woman on the curb by the church. She will burst alive in 2 minutes. You cannot believe the wind last night, the things it sells. The sun buffs the surface of technology across our city of cracks and cataracts, which in turn ignores the shoes rubbing my feet from their bones. Enter some disease where the woman sells her tears prior to civilization. That moment is now upon the funeral pyre. In the crumblings and ramblings of old men seated in tired T-shirts on stoops everlasting, they survey remainders of wars overlived and fat berries beyond the perimeter ripened, with blood brought back from dust fields by worms underfoot and pregnant. We make wine to toast the cross and tender liars.
New ways of thinking, Amy King. The voice does equal self, or the voice does not?
Both. You can say it either way, because what is the self? I mean, that is people study philosophy and ontology to describe what the self is. I mean, is it just the carnal, corporeal body, or is it, you know, this whole, you know, are my books myself?
Well, the voice in poetry mm-hmm. is so an important word.
Yeah.
Do you have a voice?
Probably not, because I think a voice comes with writing in a consistent manner. And I don't think I write consistently yet.
Oh.
I think I have done too many disparate kinds of poetries. And I don't think that you people will, at this point, I think I'm a young poet. And at this point, I don't think that you can go, oh, that poem and that poem and that poem, that's an Amy King poem.
I can. I can.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very flattering, I think.
I know your poetry. Uh-huh. And it doesn't look like Armand Trout.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't look like Howell,
mm-hmm.
you know, even though it might come from the same consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe you don't know.
Well, I mean, what you're saying there is Armand Trout is has a very distinct style that she sticks to. She's got the long stanzas, short lines, and not a lot of references to anchor yourself in as far as making a narrative. Howell has a very a thread of a very strong purpose. I mean, she's very much resurrects the unspoken histories, you know, so you recognize her voice that way. But I don't think at this point I'm not able to say, okay, this is my consistent thing that makes my me have a voice, or, you know.
Among the critics, Charles Bernstein says that yours is a poetry of hope mm-hmm. for a world shrouded by nearly and almost. That's interesting, because if anything, you're working for the immediate.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're going for, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
That, and sometimes the immediate doesn't have to have a color or a race or anything or mm-hmm. a gender or anything. It's just, here I am and this is it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what Bernstein said. Is that mm-hmm. what he said?
I think that hope for a world shrouded by nearly and almost.
See?
Well, for me, this means to me, well, first of all, my poetry is very much motivated by hope. I'm very hopeful that this will do something. And what it will do, maybe the nearly and the almost is about how we name things. I mean, when we name things, we control things. We identify something by naming it, and therefore that's the beginning of controlling. But in our heads, and this is something I think that my poetry is dealing with very often, is how thought is always secondary to what we think is real, what we think is important. It's not, thought is not considered, the processes of thought, I think, are very important in my work. I mean, sometimes people, I've had somebody say, a friend close to me say, it just sounds like you're thinking out loud. Well, that is part of it, you know. Nearly and almost, I think that the things that we assign, the public narratives, they are nearly and almost, because they're not really giving truth, as you know. I mean, look at the political table these days. We're not getting the whole truth of anything, you know. We're getting nearly and almost. I mean, even you can translate that literally, too. They're nearly worse weapons of destruction, mass destruction. They're almost were, you know, this sort of thing. And then also, just speaking on the more abstract level, everything that we see publicly does not necessarily speak truth to what the full reality is. You see what I'm saying?
I do.
Okay.
And in fact, Ron Padgett also has commented on your work. He's a poet of some distinction, and he thinks that they're very witty
mm-hmm.
and that they're very quick.
Mm-hmm.
He says, before you know it, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a metaphysical effect left over. That's what Ron Padgett says.
Mm-hmm.
And he comments upon the book Antidotes for an Alibi. Is this book still in print?
It is in print, and it's available through the small press, Blazevox. And, you know, there are copies in little local bookstores here and there. And I tend to sell a lot of copies at readings, but it's still available.
That's the place, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Poets sell books.
Do you read a lot?
I read voraciously, but I have very little patience. So I read four different things at a time, and I don't always finish everything I read, and I'm a terrible reader.
I watched you on a video, and I saw you complete your sentences, and I thought you did very well. Her poems have also been in literary journals, One is the Mississippi Review, the Brooklyn Rail, Duration Press, the Bedside Guide to No-Tell Motel, mm-hmm. and a new anthology, Access Literature.
Mm-hmm.
So you're out there.
Yeah.
You're a working poet.
Mm-hmm.
And Absolutely. This summer you're going to be working on your manuscript.
I am working on my manuscript. Well, I'm tweaking that, and I am writing something new, I think.
And your titles are very provocative.
Oh, okay.
Do you know that?
I hope they are.
Let's have another.
Okay. A final note. There is a deliberate pleasure in watching someone smoke cigarettes. Even the echo of that sentence smells like a stolen observation that the smoker is deeply, darkly thinking. In books, they brood. On screen, they are the rebel or daring victim being slowly, unknowingly undone. I've always wanted to occupy my mouth in a similar fashion and gather great thoughts from the shadowed glow erasing my face. I suckle sweet cigar substitutes instead. Savor the proximity of nature, we're taught. Toast the lung in all its sanctity and encourage its diverse role within ourselves. As always, let the credits scroll down your face before stubbing out the coal.
Did you have a copy of this on you, I Live for No?
No. I live for no. I live for no incongruous peacekeeper, the anti-cake's unsettled icing. Glamour is, as catwalking does, with all the slinking styles. How can a mother get her slice? When does the cutting end without the cellular, without the unholed wall to see through or stick a finger in?
I think you're always saying, what is meaning?
Yeah. I don't really know what it is.
That's why you keep writing, right?
Yeah, yeah. In search of it.
But what do people do that don't have this? I mean, I had a disastrous experience yesterday, and I thought, I will write a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, what does someone do when they can't say that? I don't care about anything. The world is, I am going to make this okay on my desk.
Mm-hmm. Well, meaning is always a personal thing, right? I mean, meaning can only mean because it is something to you. So those who don't write, read or look for meaning in other ways. But I mean, I read because I don't always have the meaning of something, and I look for it in other people's writing, and I look for it in my own by writing. I'm trying to create some sort of meaning, but I don't think it's a, you know, it's not something you can hold on to. It's always escaping.
Is your work an encounter or a dialogue?
Aren't encounters dialogue? it's both encounter and dialogue. I think anytime a person sits down with a piece of writing, it's a dialogue. But it's, you know, the author is obviously not there, so the reader has to be active. I mean, I think that's something that a lot of beginning students don't recognize, you know, that they're so used to things, A meaning A equals A, you know, I say A, and then that means, you know, go put your pants away in the drawer. You know, they're so used to the everyday use of language that when something comes at them that they have to make sense of, you know, it's harder. You have thinking is a process, and thinking is an exercise, an activity. So they have to put things together on their own, and this means conjuring up their own associations, and it's kind of an analytical thing, you know, creating meaning on their own.
Isn't that the second part of it, though? I mean, do you get them? Isn't that in the revision?
Well, that's the role of the author. What do you want to put forth? I mean, for me, poetry is an art too, so you have to be very careful about your materials and what you put together, because you're creating a whole piece. I mean, you don't go to a painting and say, that one line in the painting is so beautiful. I mean, you look at the painting as a whole, and you can look at the elements of the painting too, or a sculpture, or any piece of art, you know. Music, you don't go to a song and say, I only like the refrain. Everything adds to it. Everything is of equal importance and weight. Something might stand out to you, that section of the painting or that part of the song, but without the rest of it, the whole piece, that will not stand out.
You said music is not a home.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't even know you knew that, and here you explain to me why you said that, and I bet you didn't know that when you wrote that.
That music, I just explained why music is not a home?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't live in music, but you can visit it and try to make your own. Mm-hmm. But home is another concept of, instability, I think, too. We try to create a permanence in home.
jettisoning our security, our only security systems.
This is a poem called Ivy Wall of Sparrows that it practically wrote itself, or rather, I'm friends with a painter named Rob Davis who sent me an email, and I just pretty much took some words out of his email and created this poem. And he's a painter, so he's very visual.
Does he know this?
Oh, he knows this. That's why it's for Rob Davis. But it's pretty much co-opted or appropriated from Rob Davis. It's called Ivy Wall of Sparrows. I missed you at the coffee shop before sunrise, so I went along with a to-go in hand all the way to Clinton and Jerusalem, where the subway juts up from the earth's eye socket, and from the corner of my own, I twisted toward the sparrows upon sparrows, covering a 30-foot stucco wall, cracked with song, without syllables. Here comes the sun, in case I lost track of time. Tell the people you pass and inhabit later on. Take your marketable skills and raise them to this wall. Hold your brush up wet with rushes and slows and find your daytime position sings here.
I love that daytime position.
That's very much a New York poem.
It is a wonderful, wonderful line.
Usually the crowd that you see rushing to the subway, they're either going to work to, you know, people I think last in jobs in New York about 2 years, and at that point you have to go find another one. So you're always thinking about, what are my marketable skills? What can I put on my CV? I mean, I was thinking this way for a while. So this is very much a, you know.
It also speaks of, this is your... this is the time our love exists. Mm-hmm. This is a portion of your life. I'm mm-hmm. a portion of your life. Mm-hmm. This is that part.
It's got the very simple message. Stop and take a second out and smell the roses, or listen to those sparrows on that stucco wall, you know. Adolescing season. The year of the locust abstracts itself as I scrape up wings and build a nest in lieu of a room in a Hungarian inn, eating the distant soup you will consume through my brewing self-worth. Will you hold up two fists and live a life of logical fortitude? The milk of your voice spills future insect carcasses. Most animals repeat themselves, but a risk of recycling won't fit the size of my shoe. I must walk upright or else fix another history that will let my trumpet knocking in. Only take the time to see what isn't before you. The night of additional light, a 17-year trembling, and the face of copulation. Tonight recommends full examination of the stars and their planets, which, when placed beneath the sun's sky, we prove we are both certain to be. Okay, I'll read one more poem. A domestic film. This is the director's cut, a traveling space in the folded crook of your plotted hand, like silver night on 1,000 platters, spreading westward, then plywood. I watch the brittle flower spread, almost mobile with her walking petal plans. Feminine form to feminine prone, relax and slip your pronouncing eyes, like cake, only softer and heated, across the unmarried wife waving goodbye to the silent screen world of strangers safely baking on Dishwater Island.
The voice of Amy King. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Associate producer is Ken Flynn. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. This series is funded by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. I'm Grace Cavalieri.